Welcome to Small World, Big Problems, a podcast from the Philip Merrill Center for Strategic Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, D.C. My name is Connor Crago, and today I will be interviewing Professor Mark Kelton on the state of the Russian Illegals Program. Russian illegals are deep cover spies which operate in Western countries under false identities. The history of Russian illegals go all the way back to some of the earliest days of the Soviet Union, but these operatives continue to lurk in the shadows today. Famously, the FBI conducted a series of coordinated raids in 2010, which saw 10 Russian illegals arrested across the United States. Even at CICE, we faced a Russian illegal named Sergei Cherkasov, who we will discuss during the episode. Why does Russia use these operatives? Has the Russian invasion of Ukraine changed their mission? How can private institutions protect themselves from Russian intelligence? To answer these questions, we will discuss this topic with Professor Mark Kelton, a former CIA executive with decades of experience in counterintelligence work. Professor Kelton is a retired senior Central Intelligence Agency executive with 34 years of experience in intelligence operations. Professor Kelton's career included more than 16 years of overseas service, to include assignments in key CIA field leadership positions. These include his tenure as the CIA station chief in Pakistan and chief of the European Division of the National Clandestine Service. He concluded his career as deputy director of the National Clandestine Service for Counterintelligence, one of the most senior-ranking positions in the clandestine service. Directing CIA's counterintelligence and counterespionage programs, Professor Kelton led the team that protected the nation's most closely guarded secrets. Professor Kelton has comprehensive expertise in intelligence operations, international security issues, detection of insider threats, assessment of counterintelligence risk, and crisis management. Following his retirement from the CIA, Professor Kelton was a founding partner of the Five Eyes Group, LLC, a contributor to the Cipher Brief, and an adjunct professor at Georgetown University. We hope you enjoy this episode of Small World, Big Problems. Professor Kelton, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
To start, can you give us an overview of what the Russians' illegal program is and where it stands today?
So let's start a little bit of history and a little bit of definitions. What are illegals as opposed to where does the term come from? What does it mean? Illegal is a designation used by Russian intelligence to designate officers who are not under official cover, meaning they're not officially accredited to a country. Why is that significant? Number one, a person that's officially accredited will be named to that country and known as, say, a Russian diplomat or a Russian trade official or something of that sort. And consequently can be put under coverage or surveillance or suspicion by a local security service. They can be put under observation. If they are caught or involved in espionage activities and caught doing it, they can be expelled, but they are covered by diplomatic immunity. They have diplomatic status in that country. They have a legal status under the Vienna Convention and other agreements. The illegals do not have that kind of immunity. The illegal program allows that their officers, when sent abroad, must accept the risk that if they are arrested, they are not covered by diplomatic immunity and hence can be charged under Espionage Act of a local country. And so where does this program come from? Like most things in Russian intelligence, we have to look back to the past. The illegals program began in Soviet times. It was born of necessity and opportunity. Necessity. After the Soviet Revolution, the revolution that brought the Soviets to power in 1917, many countries did not recognize the Soviet Union. Therefore, they didn't have many diplomatic representations abroad. So they set up programs, they started to conduct intelligence activities, so they set up programs to use what they called nelegalni officers to do intelligence work. And many of those original illegals after the Soviet Revolution were not Russians. They were not even from what was Soviet territory. Many came from communist parties that were ideologically affiliated with the Soviet Union. It was that because the revolution in the Soviet Union drew many foreigners to it. So the opportunity for Soviet intelligence was to use the identities of people who actually were not Soviets to conduct espionage activities, and they would have a broader reach. As the program developed, well, let's take the United States, for example. The United States did not recognize the Soviet Union until the 1930s. The original representation for the Soviet Union was AMTORC, the Soviet American Trade Association, that was located in New York. And it was a semi-official organization. But at the same time, the Soviet Union was running illegal operations in the United States. So as Soviet intelligence developed, of course, this created challenges. What's the challenge of an illegal? A, they don't have that diplomatic immunity. B, communicating with them is difficult. You don't have an official platform from which to communicate with them. If somebody's in an embassy or a consulate, you can communicate. So at AMTORG became effectively a Soviet intelligence platform as it developed, as well as a trade platform. But there were others operating in the United States. So the opportunity also for them was access, and that was also a detriment. They didn't have official access, harder to get close to government officials, you would think. But the advantage they had in the 1920s and 30s was ideological. There were many people who believed in socialism, Soviet communism. So the golden age of illegal operations in the 1920s and 30s involved many of what the Soviet intelligence and Russian intelligence honors as the great illegals. Arnold Deutsch, who recruited the Cambridge Five, Theodore Mali, who handled them afterwards, Ignaz Reis, who ultimately turned on Stalin and was executed, Alexander Orlov, another defector, Krivitsky, another one who was killed. But these were all famous illegals. They were involved in famous operations. Orlov, for example, worked in Spain during the Spanish Revolution, and in fact was involved in many of the repressions of sort of the ideological deviants from Soviet communism. But the ideological affinity that many in the West had allowed the illegals to operate quite effectively. They operated on university campuses, they operated in commercial guys, all the rest. So the program, as it developed, took advantage of the natural cover of people who worked in the Comintern, which was the Communist International, and used them. And then what would happen is you had an illegal, say, an illegal candidate in the Comintern, they would gradually say and disavow communism. They would turn into maybe a fascist outwardly, or they would become the little gray man in Western society. And the goal was, of course, to recruit and to run spies in the West. Many of the best cases run by the Soviet Union in that time were run by illegals. One only has to look at some of the, not only the Cambridge Five, but a number of the ideological recruitments in the United States. The other source of illegals were people who were Soviet citizens, who had actually assumed the identity or legend, as they call it, of a foreign person. Those persons, the identity that was assumed, mainly came from two places, the identity. It came from A, Westerners who went to the Soviet Union in search of going to the homeland of Soviet communism, maybe a Brit or an American who went there. And they either themselves became illegals, say Rudolf Abel, who was actually born William Fisher in the UK, or their identities were taken and used by the illegal Directorate S of KGB to provide legends for other people. So they adopted that legend. The other source of identities were people that died in the West, perhaps at a young age, largely, and their identities were assumed also by illegals. And usually the Soviet residencies, that's the name they use for their official offices abroad, had officers in them that operated under what was called Line N. The Soviet residencies, intelligence residencies, are broken up into different lines. Line PR, political intelligence. Line X is economic intelligence. KR, counterintelligence. Line N are illegal support officers. They would go out to churches, to registry offices, look for the death certificates of people who died young and provide an identity. A great number of these also came from conquered territories. The Baltic states, after they took the Baltic states, Finland, Karelia, when they took Eastern Finland, what was part of Eastern Finland. This worked pretty well while you had ideological affinity as an advantage for Soviet intelligence, because there was a natural pool of recruits. And while the ability to track identities or persons was relatively primitive. It's all an analog society, paper. People carry passports. Passports are relatively easily duplicated. The ability to pass along information between countries, counterintelligence information, was stilted, difficult to do. After World War II, that changes. Actually, it changes before World War II, when some of the great illegals, because of the Nazi-Soviet pact and the purges, start defecting. And a lot we learn more about their program. But after World War II, it certainly changes, because the ideological recruitments, the ideological affinity that allowed illegals to support and run agents as easily, go away. But illegals also served another role, and it developed into serving another role. And that was a presence in being. And particularly during the Cold War, this develops. And what does that mean? That means if the Soviet Union were to go to war with the United States, one would assume that their official representatives would be thrown out of the country, out of the United States. They would have nobody to conduct intelligence operations, or their intelligence operations would be very much restricted. So the idea was to have a residency in being. So what you had is an illegals resident, a chief in a country, and an illegals resident. And if war broke out or there was a crisis, those illegals could take over the handling of spies and intelligence collection within a country in time of war. So they serve two roles. Also, you look at the risk calculus. If you are sitting on the other side and you are a Soviet or Russian intelligence officer who is directing a program, say a resident in Washington, D.C., there's a great risk to using illegals. The risk is if they get arrested, right? They have no diplomatic immunity. They're in prison. They're hard to get out. Somebody will have to be exchanged, as happened in 2010. So there was a reluctance, too, on the part of Soviet intelligence to employ illegals where they could use legal officers who have diplomatic immunity, also have the advantage of instant communication, also have the advantage of being under the control or under the direction of the resident directly. The resident in a country as opposed to the illegal resident. Okay, so after World War II, we see the program develop. Now, it doesn't mean illegals go away. We see Rudolf Abel, others, Conan Mullady, known as Gordon Lonsdale in the UK, and he handled the Portland spy ring, worked with the Krogers and others who were also illegals. Some famous cases involve illegals. But the use of illegals evolves more into that residence in being, And there's two reasons for that. Number one, because it becomes much more difficult to get illegals into the West. To assume an identity and to have that identity be survivable is very difficult as we go along in the post-war era, and particularly today, where you have biodata and everything else to track people as they move around the world. The ability to track people is much easier. The ability to track identities is easier. And the second reason goes back to the risk calculus of using them. So what they evolve into is they're used in very specialized cases. So surely they look for access to and try to recruit agents, but their primary goal is to be that residency in being and to provide support for operations in the time of a crisis. The Russian intelligence services are the inheritors of the Soviet intelligence services. They are proud inheritors. They talk about them. They talk about the fact that they are proud Czechists, the Cheka being the original Soviet intelligence service. They look back to the history of the Soviet intelligence services with pride, and a lot of their practices are inherited from the Soviet intelligence service. So they continue to run an illegals program, a large illegals program. And that's where we are today. I mean, we've seen cases involving illegals, particularly the 2010 arrests in the United States, where we expelled 10 of them and there was an exchange for people captured by the Russians. But those programs continue and continue to be part of the Russian intelligence arsenal, if you will.
In today's world, it is not entirely necessary for Russian intelligence assets to disguise their nationality as Russians, some examples being Anna Chapman and Maria Butina. Mm-hmm. So why is the illegals program still so important to Vladimir Putin and the greater Russian intelligence apparatus?
Well, when the 2010 illegals were arrested, Vladimir Putin actually went on TV. He went on Larry King, which was a show that existed at the time. And Larry King asked him, why do you have illegals? He said, we have illegals in case there's a war, so we have people to spy, effectively. So that would be the answer to this question. Right now, given the war in Ukraine, a lot of Russian diplomats have been expelled from various countries, particularly people identified as intelligence officers. Now, it doesn't mean all Russian intelligence officers have been kicked out of the West. But there's certainly those that remain are under more scrutiny. So the purpose of having an illegals presence, presumably, and I don't know this, that there's to run agents, to fill in. Now, you're right when you say that people don't have to have another identity, but it makes it a lot easier, acceptable to some peoples. If you're going to recruit agents, they don't want to meet a Russian. Maybe they meet somebody posing as a Pole or a Czech or something like that. And it also provides cover not to be under Russian nationality. It doesn't mean they don't use Russians. They do. There are a number of people. Anna Chapman, although, is not an example that I would cite because Anna Chapman was not a very good intelligence officer. In fact, her father was a KGB officer. So at the end, when she finally had suspicion that the issue was under scrutiny by the FBI, she actually got on the phone and called her father and said, what should I do? And she called him in Moscow. That's probably not the school solution for an illegal who's highly trained. As an aside, the Russians spend a lot of time training these people. They're trained not only in the classical espionage arts, but they have to learn the culture and the language of the place that they're going. And that takes a good deal of time. So they invest a lot of time in preparing these people. So if I was a Russian intelligence officer and somebody asked me, why do I have these people today? I have them just for this kind of circumstance where all of my, or a large number of my legal intelligence officers are expelled or under scrutiny. So I can have, at least in theory, a capability in being to use in times when Russia is engaged in not war with the West, but certainly confrontation with the West. The challenge, of course, if you're an illegal, the challenge is trying to A, maintain your cover, and B, build it. They spend a lot of time building cover. If you look at the 2010 illegals, that case, those people spent an awful lot of time trying to enhance their cover so they would look and appear to be a foreign citizen, whether it's the United States or some other identity. Typically, in the past, they've an illegal that, say, ends up in the United States goes through several other countries beforehand, whether it's Finland or South Africa. Those were big places for illegals in the past. Now, of course, you know, a Russian can come to the United States, assume they can get a visa, and come under the guise of being a banker or a student or something else. Or they can have somebody come who's under another identity and assume those guises, right? The problem is that at every stop along the way, and certainly on entry to the United States, in most instances, they will be subject to having their bio data recorded, their identifying data recorded. And over time, that can be a problem, right? So you want to be, what you're aiming for is anonymity.
As you mentioned, a lot of Russian diplomats and potential intelligence assets are under more scrutiny and perhaps expelled from their countries that they have diplomatic duties in. With that being said, are there indicators that the Russian illegals program has expanded or that Russian illegals are now taking on new responsibilities, which maybe they weren't a couple of years ago?
I think that's a safe assumption, particularly in this time of crisis coming out of the Ukraine war and this building crisis with the West and sort of and Russia's entente with China, when you're moving into a period of increased tension, particularly with the United States and its allies. Russian intelligence is certainly not going to stop working because they lose some of their official capability. So undoubtedly, they are trying to collect against the West. And that they would use all the instruments at their disposal to include illegals is a safe assumption. They, I think, probably are under great pressure right now from Vladimir Putin to collect. You think about it, you know, they're engaged in a shooting war. They're trying to assess the resilience of the West to supporting Ukraine, how long this will last, trying to predict the future course of that support, and trying to understand things like, is NATO going to enhance its defense spending? What's the attitude in each of those countries towards the war in Ukraine? How do we target our disinformation operations most effectively against those populations? All of those sorts of questions are things that they undoubtedly are tasking illegals to try to find out, particularly if their official presence is reduced. Certainly, they haven't moved to a wartime kind of footing, but of course, in wartime, if there was actual hostilities, then those illegals would support direct action operations and the like. Not only intelligence monitoring, but sabotage and other things like that. You've seen, of course, Russian intelligence act aggressively on foreign soil, going after dissidents, going after defectors in particular. Now, you know, if we go back historically and look at, let's say, the assassination of Trotsky in Mexico City, many of the people involved in that, in fact, the vast majority, were not officially covered Soviet intelligence officers. They used fellow travelers from the Comintern, they used illegals on all sorts of people to try to track Trotsky and then ultimately kill him. So I would say it's also a safe bet that whenever possible and necessary, illegals are being used to gather information on dissidents abroad, but particularly defectors from Russian intelligence. They reserve particular scorn for them. And we've seen a number of attacks on dissidents abroad, Litvinenko, Skripal, others. And there was a defector from Ukraine killed in Spain recently. Now, we don't know the details of that operation. the assassins were likely not illegals. It's not like the Americans, the TV show. But the people that kind of plan that operation undoubtedly drew on people that have local knowledge to try to track these folks. So I would say that they're probably very active. On the Americans, by the way, I actually was on a panel with the cast of the Americans for their last show. So, you know, you can see me on YouTube on that, on Reel to Reel. Yeah.
As you know, SICE itself had an experience with a Russian illegal. Mm-hmm. A Russian intelligence officer named Sergei Cherkasov came to SICE under a false identity, mm-hmm. posing as a Brazilian national under the name Victor Mueller Ferreira. There are ethical restraints which prevent Western universities from operating any sort of counterintelligence programs on their students. Is there any way, then, that private institutions like think tanks and universities can protect themselves?
Well, I mean, that raises a number of questions. So I guess we should speak first to why was he there? What was the purpose? Why was he there? He was undoubtedly there because SICE is an institution, one of the elite institutions in the United States for people aspiring to go into the national security sector, not only the United States, but friendly countries. He was undoubtedly there to spot and assess, in intelligence terms, people that might be susceptible to approach or influence, looking at students. Now, the student milieu has traditionally been a good place to recruit for intelligence services, right? If you're recruiting spies, you recruit for access or you recruit for potential. Recruit for access, you have somebody that's already in a job. Recruit for potential, somebody that may get into a job. Now, of course, the latter is problematic. You can recruit 10 people and none of them get into a job. But if you get one into a job that counts, probably worth the effort. So, you know, I think that's, if on the face of it, why that would be happening. I mean, he's not alone. The Russians aren't alone in doing this. The Chinese do it heavily, right? Send people to universities in the United States. In their case, they're there to look at not only potential candidates for recruitment, but to monitor their own students looking for dissident activity. Keeping in mind that all authoritarian states, their first imperative is to protect the regime. So our friend here, in this case, the Russian under Brazilian cover, right, that comes to the United States is undoubtedly also looking at Russians who are abroad, the foreign colony abroad. There's a long history of this in Soviet intelligence because they're worried about dissidents. Now, what does a university do about it? A university is, by definition, an open learning place, right? It's supposed to foster engagement with the world, and that's particularly true, I assume, of an institution like SICE, right? You're supposed to be engaging in discussions of national security issues, and that's more vibrant. The academic community is more vibrant if you have foreign participation. So the ethical and regulatory and policy constraints aside, there's cultural constraints too. You don't want to turn people away who can come and contribute to that kind of dialogue. That makes it very difficult for a university. And you can't, as you say, have people spotting and assessing who amongst the student body is not loyal to what. I mean, if you have a foreigner come in, who are they loyal to, right? So by definition, it's open. So the only path open to a university is to be receptive to some engagement with law enforcement or counterintelligence entities. If they come to you and say there's a problem, then to cooperate as fully as you can within the bounds of legal constraints and other things. In the United States, that's the FBI, right? The FBI comes knocking and says, you know, there's a problem on your campus among one of your students. There's a reputational issue, of course. It's a double-edged for an institution like SICE or any other academic institution cooperating with the FBI. Well, that rubs people some wrong way, but having a Russian spy on your campus is also bad. So it's always a judgment call, right? You know, And I think having an open mind and being willing to work with law enforcement when they come and talk about those things is prudent. There's also preventative measures, too. I mean, if you're talking not so much about the Russians, because they don't have the kind of reach that the Chinese do, for instance, but there are a lot of Chinese-funded academic programs that have been used as cover for espionage activities or monitoring dissidents, and particularly the Confucius Institutes and other things of that sort. So when you have institutions that are set up like that, that are funded by foreign governments, it's always wise to keep an eye on them in terms of, are they staying within the bounds of what the program is supposed to be?
As you alluded to earlier, in 2010, the FBI conducted a sting operation, which resulted in 10 Russian illegals being apprehended all across the United States. As a result of the investigation, it appeared that these Russian agents mostly did not obtain any substantial sensitive information through their many years in the United States. Double agents such as Robert Hansen and Anna Montes, as well as leakers such as Snowden, Manning, and recently an Air National Guardsman, have had a far more dire impact on sensitive information landing in the hands of America's adversaries. With this being said, again, why does Russia continue to send illegals into Western countries if they have limited utility and, when they're caught, create a potential diplomatic fallout?
Okay, definitionally, a double agent, Hansen was not a double agent, just for instance, nor was Montes. They're agents. Double agent is somebody that's flipped back, right? Just as a point of definition. Of course, they were, if you look at both those cases, Montes, of course, was a case that ran for the Cubans for quite a long time. She worked at Defense Intelligence Agency. Hansen worked at FBI. They were classical espionage cases and penetrations of United States security services, intelligence services, delivering information to the other side, which is the goal of any intelligence service, right, is to penetrate their adversary. The illegals, the 2010 case, fascinating case because it ran for a decade. You know, the FBI gave it the moniker Ghost Stories. And Ghost Stories was an operation that required tremendous effort on the part of the United States to keep, number one, these people under surveillance, and number two, to understand fully and to develop information from it as to how the illegals worked. That was the value of that operation from the U.S. point of view. That meant looking at how they communicated, looking at the technical gear they may have used, how they built their cover legends, how they lived their lives, how they developed their cover, how they interacted with each other, their espionage-related activities, or trying to uncover if there were espionage-related activities. And I think what we learned from that is, A, they engaged in an awful lot of what we call tradecraft, an awful lot of activity to maintain and build cover, to look normal, like the neighbor next door. And in fact, when they were arrested, many people, oh, they seem so nice. You know, they were using all sorts of tradecraft measures to ensure the security of their communications. They used electronic communications. They used traditional tradecraft, which would say dead drops, dead drop in intelligence parlance, putting down a package. They used signals. They used brush contacts where they went by each other in stairwells and things. And the FBI recorded all of this. It's brilliant stuff, brilliant operational activity. So the question you're asking, and a question that the FBI asked itself all through the operation, is why are they doing all this if they're not producing intelligence? Because the whole goal of having a spy, right, is to get intelligence, to understand what your adversary is doing. So, you know, it's a lot of effort, 10 years of effort for what would appear to be very little return. And to answer that question, I go back to the original question you asked, which is, why does the program exist at all? And it is, as it's evolved, not only to collect intelligence, but to have a presence in being. So theoretically, let's just say we hadn't uncovered Ghost Stories illegals. and they are in the United States. They're untouched. They're operating. The Russian residency here gets kicked out in Washington, out of the United States. And it certainly is lesser numbers than they used to be because of the Ukraine war and restrictions and back and forth between the two countries. They would be free to take on the duties of that residency. Let's say there's another Anna Montez who's out there, or another Hansen who's out there. And there's always spies. I mean, Paul Redmond, who was CIA officer who actually led the team that uncovered Ames, he says that in actuarial certainty, there are spies operating in the United States government today. It's just true historically. So if those people hadn't been uncovered, then the illegals would have been free to take over those agents in time. And that's why they exist. Now, again, we go back to the risk factor involved. There is a lot of risk. They get arrested. It causes a huge diplomatic kerfluffle, which resulted in this case, of course, of an exchange. The exchange at Vienna Airport, where the illegals were indicted in the United States and flown out and then exchanged at Vienna Airport for a number of people arrested in Russia. That's a price that the Russians are willing to pay. They don't want to pay it, but they're willing to pay it, which is why, of course, you know, if you look at what's going on at sort of the macro level, why do they keep prisoners in Russia? Why do they arrest Wall Street Journal reporters or former Marines or people off the street? It's to have tokens and chits to play in those sorts of exchanges, which when you think about it, it tells you that they must be running agents and running operations that they think will entail risk. It's to have those cards to play when something happens. So I guess the calculus is not the way we would look at it and say, well, okay, they're not getting immediate return on those people. Maybe that's not the goal. Maybe the goal is long-term return in extremis. And Russia has a history of spying. They've spied in the past. They're spying now. They will continue to spy. So you have to look at it all on a continuum, trying to anticipate problems. Now, the illegals that were arrested in 2010, we don't know if they're the only ones that exist. I presume there are others operating in the United States. Now, whether they're actually active now, hopefully the FBI knows. I don't.
I believe this topic makes it pretty easy to be paranoid. To wrap up this episode, what advice would you give to individuals that are in universities, think tanks, or other private institutions which are targeted by Russian intelligence?
Well, you know, if something seems odd, it probably is, right? I mean, most people have a pretty good instinct. They're being asked all sorts of personal questions that they feel uncomfortable with, that the person is asking them about. I know I'm a student, but I also work at the Defense Intelligence Agency, and somebody's asking me about my work and, you know, what kind of work I have. Or somebody says to me something like, hey, would you write a research paper for my think tank? And I'll pay you a little bit of money, you know, and you don't have to talk about anything classified, but I'm interested in. Most people have a pretty good instinct for those sorts of things. It's not to be paranoid, but even paranoids have enemies, right? So when people operate in life, you know, they interact with people, they have a pretty good sense when something is not quite right. It doesn't mean everybody's a spy. They just could be odd, right? They just could be an odd person. But if it gets to the point where you think you really have suspicions, then the only thing to do is to approach somebody and say something about it, right? And, you know, the people to approach are really the FBI. If there's somebody that's asking questions, you know, many students, I don't know if it's this way at SAIS, but I've taught in the past, many of my students they have students as a second job. A lot of them are military. A lot of them are law enforcement. When you're at the graduate level, people have to work many times as well. right? So they're kind of doing two things. And if people come to you, or if a person comes to you and posing as a, I don't know, a Brazilian, and starts asking you questions about your job, your family, your background, and it gets too intrusive, and then they start offering you those kind of contracts or things like that. Let's try to have meetings, but I don't want other people to know, you know, that we're meeting, that kind of thing. That's probably not good. And it's probably time to talk to somebody about it. By and large, though, you know, people that get targeted by intelligence organizations, they know they're being targeted. Intelligence officers want gradually to ratchet up that request to deepen that relationship. And the people that go along with it are generally people that have been assessed well by the targeting officer, right? But that's not the vast majority of people. Most people sense nefariousness. You know, their agents are agents for a reason. They're odd. They're different than other people. Most people will say, that's a bit strange. Maybe I should talk to somebody about that. And if it is strange, then, you know, that's what you should do.
Professor Kelton, thank you for your time and for providing us some of your expertise.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Good luck to you all.
Thank you. For all of our listeners out there, Small World, Big Problems is a student-led production sponsored by the Philip Merrill Center for Strategic Studies at Johns Hopkins University's Paul H. Nitzes School of Advanced International Studies, located in Washington, D.C. Small World, Big Problems can be found on Spotify, Apple, Amazon, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to become part of the podcast, suggest a guest for the show, or just send us your feedback, please email us at sicestrategypodcast@gmail.com. Thank you to Eli George for his creative assistance in making this episode. I'm Connor Crago. We'll be back soon with a new episode. See you all soon.